7415 WBCQ, Monticello, Maine, USA.
The world's weekly wait is over. Like magic, an invisible chain of sound once more circles the planet.
Yes, sir, this sort of thing has happened before.
There's a very famous quote, trying to stop bits from being copied is like trying to stop water from being wet.
It's the most diabolical looking piece of equipment I've ever seen.
Welcome to This Week in Amateur Radio International. This is your weekly amateur radio and technology news magazine of the air. This is edition number 176, with a release and air date of Sunday, June 8th, 2008.
Okay, we're rolling. Stand by, please.
Here are the stories making news this week in amateur radio.
The ARRL files comments with the Federal Communication Commission on two matters relating to amateur radio. Hams heed the call when tornadoes sweep through Colorado and respond to assistant communications during the wildfires in Florida. A ham radio group in California is asking the FCC when a repeater is a repeater and when it's something else. An unneeded petition on amateur radio is filed to mistake by Industry Canada. And this August, it's time to go north to Alaska. We'll tell you why in this week's report.
These stories come to you in a moment along with this week's special features. Bill Barron, N2FNH, will be here with another Random Access Thought. Leo Laporte will be here with all the latest technology news and commentary. And this week we feature Bill Continelli, W2XOY, who will be here with another edition of the Ancient Amateur Archives. This and a lot more are straight ahead on This Week in Amateur Radio International.
Reporting from the land just west of the Great White North, I'm Peter Summers, KL2GY.
And reporting from our Northeast News Bureau in Syracuse, New York, I'm Chris Perrine, KB2FAF.
And reporting for our Mid-Atlantic News Bureau from high atop the Allegheny Mountains near Altoona, Pennsylvania, I'm Wayne Nelms, N4DCL.
Reporting from our Northeast News Bureau in Glassboro, New Jersey, where I survived a rear-end collision last week, but my beloved Honda CR-V did not. I'm Corey Sickles, WA3UVV.
20 minutes of solid amateur radio news begins now.
On Tuesday, May 27th, the ARRL filed electronic comments concerning two matters that the FCC has under consideration. The first set of comments concerns a company that filed a request for a waiver of Part 90 of the FCC rules. Recon Robotics, an electronics manufacturer, wishes to sell and for its public safety customers to use a robotic device that operates in the 430 to 448 megahertz band. The primary allocation in that portion of the spectrum is the United States government radio location, or military radars. The amateur service has an allocation there on a secondary basis. The second matter deals with GE Healthcare and their request for allocation of spectrum as a secondary user in the 2300 megahertz band. The amateur service has a primary allocation in a portion of the requested band. On January 11, 2008, Recon Robotics filed a request with the FCC for a waiver of Part 90 of the Commission's rules with respect to the Recon Scout, a remote-controlled, maneuverable surveillance robot designed for use in areas that may be too hazardous for human entry. This device can be thrown, dropped, or launched into hazardous areas and can provide an operator located a safe distance away with video and audio, along with infrared, biological, chemical, heat, radiation, or other data. According to the FCC, Recon Robotics seeks a waiver to permit equipment authorization of the Recon Scout and its use by state and local law enforcement and firefighting agencies and by security personnel in critical infrastructure industries. The FCC said a waiver is required to permit licensing of the Recon Scout because the device operates in the 430 to 448 megahertz band. Recon Robotics asserts that because the Recon Scout operates with 1 watt of peak power, it's unlikely to cause interference to these services. The ARRL contends that because this device operates on a channelized basis, each of the three channels being 6 megahertz wide, the necessary bandwidth of the device is apparently close to 6 megahertz. Recon Robotics, ask that it be granted an unspecified series of permanent waivers to allow the marketing and sale to and use of this device by law enforcement and fire department personnel for public safety applications. The amateur service, which has a heavily occupied secondary allocation in the 420 to 450 megahertz band, would be potentially substantially impacted by the grant of these waivers. The ARRL's comments also state that Recon Robotics fails to establish that the 420 to 450 megahertz band is the only viable choice and that no other band would be suitable, an obligation of the petitioner in order to entitle it to a waiver. In requesting the waiver, ARRL asserts that Recon Robotics only claimed, but did not show, prove, or demonstrate that other bands were not suitable for its purposes. In other cases before the FCC, as recent as 2006, the Commission denied such waivers, saying, "We do not believe that the public interest requires grant of a waiver merely to accommodate the manufacturer's choice of a specific frequency when others are available." The ARRL contends in its comments that nothing in the four corners of Recon Robotics' request indicates anything that would verify the factual conclusions offered. The waiver request boils down to, "Trust us, we have checked into this." The ARRL points out in its comments that there are differing amateur operations throughout the 420 to 450 megahertz band. One of the channels Recon Robotics is requesting use of, 442 to 448 megahertz, is used by amateur repeaters, with band plans varying by locality, and also for amateur television repeater inputs. These repeater inputs, both for voice and video, are at high locations, where line of sight to Recon Robotics devices should be expected anywhere in the United States. Repeaters in this band are routinely used for emergency communications via amateur radio for numerous served agencies, including FEMA. And so at times when Recon Robotics devices may be expected to be used, the repeaters may be expected to be in operation in the same areas, ARRL comments state. For this reason as well, the ARRL maintains that interference to the Recon Scout device may be expected on a regular basis from amateur radio operations. While it is all well and good for Recon Robotics, a manufacturer, to suggest that it understands that operation of the device will be subject to interference received from licensed users in the band, such interference is not a comforting thought for licensed radio amateurs who could very easily be perceived to be or held responsible for the failure or malfunction of these analog devices in a given application and the danger to public safety officers who are relying on them. It is also too much to expect that a public safety licensee will understand that the use of the device is unpredictable because interference to the device is unpredictable. Recon Robotics is correct about one thing. Amateur radio operators take the relationship with first responders very seriously. Creating fundamental incompatibility between public safety communications and amateur radio operations serves no one well at all. And for this reason, Recon Robotics should reconfigure its device to operate in a different allocation. The ARRL urges the FCC to deny the waiver request, either permanently or even temporarily, and calls on the Commission to require Recon Robotics to initiate a rulemaking proceeding if it feels that Part 90 or Part 15 rules governing analog devices are not sufficiently accommodating and should be changed, and could be changed consistent with interference avoidance. Repeatedly granting waivers for analog devices which do not meet the fundamental interference avoidance requirements of the existing rules is bad spectrum management and ill serves the amateur service. In December 2007, GE Healthcare filed ex parte comments in response to a notice of inquiry in the pending Med Radio proceeding, proposing that the band 2360 to 2400 MHz be allocated on a secondary basis for Body Sensor Networks, or BSNs. These systems are apparently to be used for wireless patient monitoring. They are very short-range networks, consisting of multiple body-worn sensors and nodes, connected via wireless to nearby hub stations at medical facilities and in homes. The amateur radio service is currently allocated 2390 to 2400 MHz on a primary basis. In its comments, the ARRL states it does not expect a significant amount of harmful interference to amateur operations at 2390 to 2400 MHz from BSNs. GE Healthcare's proposal, however, makes erroneous assumptions about amateur uses in these bands, and the interference potential for the devices to amateur radio stations and residential areas is not known. According to GE Healthcare, they propose an allocation of the entire 2360 to 2400 MHz band for use of the BSN devices. But the ARRL contends that in any given area, only 20 MHz of that band would be used. GE Healthcare's proposal specifically mentions amateur radio and claims that because band 2390 to 2400 MHz is designed for fast scan video, high rate data, packet, control, and auxiliary applications, and not weak signal communications, it is well suited for sharing with the BSN systems. The ARRL argued that this is a misconception on GE Healthcare's part. The fact is that there are no limitations on the type of amateur uses to be made in these bands, and the band may in fact be used in some areas for weak signal communications on a completely unpredictable basis. The uses of this band plan by radio amateurs, though guided overall by national band plan, are very much subject to local variation, dictated by custom and usage. Weak signal amateur communications utilizes long propagation path, very low received signal levels, and very high transmitted signal levels. The band is also used for long distance data, voice, and television communications using relatively weak received signal levels. The ARRL, in its comments, said it is far more concerned about potential interference to BSNs from licensed amateur radio operations in the 2390 to 2400 MHz band. The ramifications of radio frequency interference, or RFI, to these systems in terms of danger to medical patients are obvious and potentially severe. The ARRL contends that the potential for interference from amateur radio operations, which are in this band occasionally inherent and mobile, but most often fixed in residential areas to BSNs operated at a patient's residence, would be a problem. In light of the possibilities to harmful interference, the ARRL requested that the FCC not proceed with the proposal of GE Healthcare as proposed in the 2390 to 2400 MHz band.
This is North America's premier amateur radio news magazine of the air, This Week in Amateur Radio.
Just exactly when is a repeater, and when is it something else? That's the question currently before the Federal Communications Commission. Who gave the FCC that question? The Northern California Packet Association. The group wants to know, and has filed a request for clarification, that asks the FCC to define what it means by the term simultaneously, as it is used when defining just what a repeater is. According to the FCC's Bill Cross, W3TN, speaking at the recent Dayton Hamvention FCC Forum, this question is the result of some folks who claim that D-Star repeaters are not repeaters by virtue of their inherent analog-to-digital and digital-to-analog conversion delay.
The issue here is that in California, D-Star repeaters have been coordinated on channels that are set aside for auxiliary stations, on the basis that because there is a delay in retransmission of the signal, the retransmission is not simultaneous, and therefore the repeating station is not a repeater. Others have advanced a variant of the duck argument. If the station looks like a repeater, if it functions like a repeater, and it sounds like a repeater, it should be treated as a repeater and confined to the repeater's subbands. A look at the report and order the Commission put out in a previous docket, it was docket 93-85, will shed some light on this issue.
The applicable rule that Bill Cross seems to be referring to is section 93.7, subpart 36. It defines a repeater as an amateur station that instantaneously retransmits on a different channel the angle-modulated phone or image emission transmission of another amateur station. But this rule was written before the advent of digital audio systems that by their very nature have some inherent delay. Whether or not the FCC will strictly adhere to this definition or modify it to meet current technology could well determine the future of digital audio repeaters. Bill Cross says that a decision on this issue will be coming from the Commission in the not-too-distant future.
And now, here's a wrap-up of radio from around the world. The Bulgarian National Radio this week began DRM digital broadcast for listeners abroad. Presenting the project, BNR Director General Valery Todorov said, "We hope to be able to attract attention to the need for more accelerated rates and joining the digital era. The digital trials will continue with a six-hour-long mix of BNR's three channels, Horizont, Histrobotev, and Radio Bulgaria, in five languages. The broadcasts are designed for citizens of Central and Western Europe, as well as the extensive Bulgarian diaspora there. The new technology will make it possible to effect substantial cutbacks on BNR broadcasting costs, improve the quality of the service, and transmit integrated multimedia product," Valery Todorov said. According to the DRM Consortium, the trial will run for 6 months. Mexico's Federal Telecommunication Commission announced last week that it's authorizing radio stations within 320 kilometers or 200 miles from its border with the United States to begin transmitting in digital HD radio technology. In an official statement, the COFETEL said, considering the extent of development and implementation of the IBOC system in the United States of America, Mexico is required to take decisive action so that the country's AM and FM radio stations in the zone located within the 320 kilometers of the northern border of Mexico can transmit at the same technology level so that they can provide the benefits of quality of service to the radio listening public. It went on to state that the stations that want to transmit with the IBOC HD radio system must request authorization from the COFETEL and must commit to assisting the commission in studying the technology. Yemen, preparing new law to allow private broadcasters. The Ministry of Information in Yemen is preparing a law allowing broadcast of private television channels and radio stations, said the Minister of Information, Hassan Alazi. We are currently working with the Ministries of Legal Affairs and Communication and Information Technology to issue two laws related to communications, audiovisual information, he stated. Alazi made this announcement at the opening ceremony of the Third Festival of Radio and Television organized by the Faculty of Information at Sanaa University. The media has become a huge force for national development, and we cannot stand in front of its contributions. The Ministry of Information and Media Organization is contemplating how to make our media assume its responsibility in aiding real development and freedom of opinion and thinking, he said. Alazi stated that the political leadership's instructions were clear about recognizing the role of media space in Yemen, pointing to the opening of a bouquet of Yemen television. He emphasized the opening of a religious-oriented channel in the coming stage on a bouquet of Yemen, which will fill the vacuum and play a key role in media work. The most important step is to expand participation in media freedoms, and the University of Sanaa's play a major role in producing media professionals who can forge dynamic institutions that enrich our community, he added.
And now, with his segment on working amateur radio satellites, here is AMSAT North America's own Bruce Page, KK5DO.
A report has been received via Michael Chen, BD5RV-4, that a new amateur radio satellite is predicted to be launched by China in early 2009. It will be called CAS-1, and they have completed IARU frequency coordination. All the hardware has been finished. The payload is planned to include a CW telemetry beacon, linear transponder, FM repeater, and a digital storm forward transponder. The operations will use 70 centimeter downlink and 2 meter uplink at 500 milliwatts of output power. The satellite is expected to have a mass of 30 kilograms and be launched from China into a sun synchronous orbit with a 670 kilometer apogee. The CAS-1 team is waiting for another payload to be finished before launch. There is an upgrade to the software for the LVB tracker. The current version is 0.9. This software upgrade fixes a few problems. However, if you are not experiencing any problems with your current LVB tracker, you do not need to perform the upgrade. This is Bruce Page, KK5DO.
An odd story out of Canada where misinformation on the part of one that the nation's telecommunications regulators led to an unneeded petition from the ham radio community. One asking that the nation's political leaders to force Industry Canada to resume regulating the nation's ham radio operators, and even though it had never stopped doing so. Here's how it happened. Back in early May, Eddie Pereri, VA3EDP, sent a letter to Industry Canada regarding interference complaints in the Canadian Amateur Radio Service. The reply he received on May 13th from the Spectrum Management Department in Toronto likely caught him off guard. It read, and we quote, "The amateur band is self-policing now because it has been de-licensed for the past few years. Industry Canada is no longer the regulatory body overseeing the amateur radio band operations." This response did not sit well with VA3EDP, and he decided to do something about it. His action came in the form of that online petition to Canadian parliamentary leaders that urged them to force Industry Canada to resume regulating the Canadian amateur radio service. The petition garnered close to 300 signatures in its short life, some from real heavyweights in Canadian ham radio politics. Well, you guessed it. The Industry Canada bureaucrat who had responded to Pereri's original information request was totally wrong. Industry Canada had not abandoned the nation's hams and has no plans to do so. But it took intervention from Radio Amateurs of Canada to straighten it all out. On May 20th, Radio Amateurs of Canada contacted Industry Canada, which confirmed that the information sent to VA3EDP was incorrect. In fact, the agency affirmed it has regulatory authority for amateur radio in Canada. VA3EDP has since received a message from the acting director of Industry Canada's Toronto office confirming that the original unsigned email was sent in error. He says that he will be meeting an official of Industry Canada in the near future to discuss a spectrum management issue that was the cause of his initial inquiry with Industry Canada.
From the United States of America, you're listening to Amateur Radio's premier news magazine of the air, This Week in Amateur Radio International.
Now, let's see.
Hey, 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 what's with all this crazy cockamamie noise?
Oh, hello there. It's my brand new collection of radio pagers and beepers. I had them all programmed to the same telephone number, so I could hear them all go off simultaneously.
I suppose you got all this stuff on.
That's right.
I'm Evolved.
Here, now watch this. I'll do it again.
I'm out of here.
Amazing as it may seem, pagers and beepers are still around, and they are still being repaired and maintained. A dead medium that refuses to die. That's the subject of the next Random Access Thought, coming up in just a few minutes, right here, on This Week in Amateur Radio.
Do you suffer from the heartbreak of brain rot, feeling bored, sluggish, listless, not had a new idea in days, using electronic gizmos without a clue why they work? Now there's help. Ham Radio, guaranteed to stimulate your corroding neurons and open a whole new world of excitement. To learn more about Ham Radio, go to helloradio.org.
Side effects of Ham Radio usage include mental stimulation, desire for education, new career paths, understanding of technology, and cases of addiction have been reported. If you experience any of these symptoms, you're welcome.
Ham Radio, it's not your granddaddy's radio anymore.
You thought it was your set. Just me, I have a slow focus. Okay, Ted.
We now pause 10 seconds for station identification.
We're on shortwave and the internet. WBCQ, Vermont and Salem, Maine, USA.
The program is This Week in Amateur Radio.
Remember
the original.
Jukebox Gold. The music and memories.
Let me tell you a story about a boll weevil. Now, some of you may not know, but a boll weevil is an insect, and he's found mostly where cotton grows. Now, where they come from, nobody really knows. But this is the way the story goes. The farmer said to the boll weevil, "I see you're on the square." Boll weevil said to the farmer, "Say, yep, my whole darn family's here. We gotta have a home. Gotta have a home." The farmer said to the boll weevil, "Say, why'd you pick my farm?" The weevil just laughed at the farmer and said, "Say, we ain't gonna do you much harm. We're looking for home." And the boll weevil spot him a lightning bug. He said, "Hey, I'd like to make a trade with you. Cause you see, if I was a lightning bug, I'd search the whole night through. Searching for home.
I'd have beef when you're home. And the boll weaver called the farmer and said, you better sell your old machines, 'cause when I'm through with your cotton, you can't even buy gasoline. I'm gonna take me a home. Gotta have a home. And the boll weaver said to the farmer, says, farmer, I'd like to wish you well. Farmer said to the boll weaver, yeah, I wish that you went looking for a home. Looking for a home. Ah, you'd have a home, all right. You'd have a home. A real hot home.
Connecting to... the Random Access Thought.
Oh, hello there. Let me introduce myself. My name is Boleslav Krasnov. I'm a senior technician here at Canarsie Wireless, right in the heart of Brooklyn, New York, the fourth largest city in the U.S. of A. I've been working here for the past 45 years, fixing all kinds of electronic stuff, from vintage reel-to-reel tape recorders to fax machines and cell phones. One of the things we still repair here are radio pagers and beepers, and that's because there are folks out there who still use them, and they still break them, and they still want them to be put back together again. These cockamamie things have been around, it seems, forever, but they became a big thing in the 1980s, and that's when cell phones, back then, were a big novelty item, and I do mean big. They were as big as a brick, batteries that drained in minutes.
Beverly, would you get that phone for me, please?
The beeper was a status symbol. It was the first generation radio of demand that everybody stuck in their pockets and hooked on their trouser belts. Some of these things actually got small enough you could easily drop them in a toilet. And they made a lot of noise, beeping and boping and buzzing and vibrating. The pager was linked to doctors and their patients, to drug dealers and their clients, and government overlords to their suffering minions. According to my facts and figures, there was something like 45 million beepers in use around the country in 1999. Nowadays, it's like 7 million. Yeah, the beeper's a real fossil now. We've got the cell phones and the PDA and the laptop that can do so much more, for which we pay so much more for. You parents can really annoy your kids by telling them that you only paid $9 a month instead of like $50 on a monthly fee for the cell phone nowadays.
Beverly, answer that phone, will ya?
The biggest company still doing business is USA Mobility, and they provide service for something like 4 million pagers nationwide. Motorola stopped making them back in 2001, but not all those 40 million devices went out in the garbage. Companies like mine still refurbish them. Places like hospitals still use them. They still need the beeper because the radio signals can easily cut into buildings, and they don't cause problems for radio frequency sensitive medical machinery. Here at Canarsie Wireless, we got steel walls, so there's no QRM. We still got the big oscilloscopes and a couple of 486s around running on the MS-DOS, the old MS-DOS platform there, so we can reconfigure these ancient pager codes. Yeah, in the old days, we had super heavy plexiglass windows installed, and we had a couple of really big dogs, because some of our clientele was drug dealers and wise guys. Back then, we had like 10 guys working in the shop around the clock. We had company cars with hired drivers with two-way radios, pickup, and delivery.
Beverly! Would you get that phone?
Yeah, it was quite a time back then. It was quite a time. Those were the days, man. Those were the days.
This is Bill Barron.
Beverly! Answer the... Beverly! Answer the phone, will ya?
N to F and H. Disconnecting from... The Random Access Thought.
Welcome to the Ancient Amateur Archives. I'm Bill Continelli, W2XOY.
On November 2nd, 1920, Warren G. Harding was elected President of the United States. Millions read the election results in the newspapers the next day. In the Pittsburgh area, however, hundreds heard the election returns the moment they were wired in, thanks to Dr. Frank Conrad, a Westinghouse employee who broadcast the results over 8XK, his amateur station. This station would evolve into KDKA, and the night of November 2nd, 1920, has been called the start of the multi-billion dollar broadcast industry. But was it? This month, let's take a look at the evolution of broadcasting and the amateur's role in it. The idea of broadcasting was first considered by Lee DeForest in May 1902, when he wrote that, ultimately, wireless telephony will be possible. He urged the financial backers of the DeForest Wireless Telegraph Company to develop and patent the concept. The stockholders, however, were more interested in immediate profits through massive stock sales rather than genuine development, and refused to finance the necessary research. Undaunted, DeForest in 1907 formed the DeForest Radio Telephone Company. In a statement that for 1907 must have appeared to be radical or even bizarre, but was amazingly prophetic, he wrote, "I look forward to the day when opera may be brought into every home. Someday the news and even advertising will be sent out over the wireless telephone." Despite DeForest's intense interest in this area, he was not the first to broadcast the human voice and music over the airwaves. That honor belongs to Reginald Fessenden, a Canadian professor. He was the first to recognize the inherent flaw in the concept of spark transmissions and set out to find an alternative. His quest led him to Schenectady, New York, and the services of General Electric's most brilliant scientist, Charles Steinmetz. Fessenden explained his idea: an alternator capable of generating waves of 100,000 cycles per second, or 3,000 meters. Steinmetz and his assistant, Ernst Alexanderson, worked for almost 2 years and finally produced an alternator that met Fessenden's requirements. The Alexanderson alternator, as it was now known, was delivered to Fessenden's station in the fall of 1906. On the evening of December 24, 1906, ship and amateur operators heard something in their headphones they had never heard before. Someone speaking. A woman singing. Someone reading a poem. Fessenden himself played the violin. Not to be outdone, DeForest continued his radio telephone experiments in the period of 1907 through 1910, broadcasting from the Eiffel Tower and live from the stage of the Metropolitan Opera, where Enrico Caruso was singing. However, all of these transmissions had one major problem. Without a pure, stable, direct current CW carrier to modulate, all of the signals had a background whine and distortion. Real development in the area of modulated carriers would have to wait until Armstrong discovered the oscillating properties of a regenerative circuit. By 1916, both Armstrong's circuit and the Audion were widely circulating in the radio world and broadcasting surfaced again. Lee DeForest resumed his transmissions with programs of good music, culture, and lectures. DeForest can be credited with two firsts in 1916, the first advertisements for his Audion and other products, and the broadcast of the presidential election between Woodrow Wilson and Charles Evans Hughes. Unfortunately, DeForest signed off before the California results were in, so he declared Hughes the winner over Wilson. Also in 1916, amateur station 2ZK broadcast 1 hour of music each night. David Sarnoff, who had manned his station during the Titanic disaster, also got into the act. He wrote a memo to his employers at American Marconi suggesting a radio music box, which would become a household utility. He went on to describe his vision of radio broadcasting and then turned to finances. He predicted an income of $75 million a year from the sales of receivers. Marconi, still focusing on ship-to-shore telegraphy, took no action on the memo. After amateurs had returned to the air in November of 1919, hundreds of them began to explore the area of broadcasting. In May 1920, amateur station 8XK joined many other hams in the transmission of music. Incidentally, it was legal for amateurs to broadcast music, news, sports, lectures, advertisements, or indeed just about anything else they wanted. The Radio Act of 1912, still in effect, did not mention amateurs. Rather, one paragraph made a general reference to individual private or commercial stations. The only real restriction was the 1 kilowatt power limit and the 200 meter wavelength. After that, the government didn't care. Thus, those amateurs who had built equipment to modulate their CW transmitters eventually played a phonograph record or two, sang, or tried to sing, or broadcast some form of entertainment. With all of the above documented evidence, why is November 2, 1920 considered the start of broadcasting? The answer lies not at the transmitter, but at the receiver. Prior to that night, all broadcasts had, in effect, been from one amateur to another or to a commercial station. The November broadcast, though, was designed and promoted by Westinghouse as a transmission to the general public. Starting in September, stores were selling basic receivers for $10 to receive 8XK. Westinghouse, in effect, had seized DeForest and Sarnoff's idea and was marketing it to the general public. Thus, it was the makeup of the listening audience that defined the start of broadcasting. When the word of this successful transmission got out, more amateurs got into the act and set up their own little broadcast stations. By the end of 1921, it was estimated that about 1,200 amateurs had made at least one broadcast. Some had a regular schedule of programs and would evolve into commercial stations. Others did it just out of curiosity. But there were listeners. Over 400,000 people heard the Dempsey-Carpenter fight on July 2, 1921. Radio sales were approaching 100,000 per year, not counting crystal sets, which were selling at the rate of 20,000 per month. However, with this explosive growth came two problems for the amateur. The first was an identity crisis. What should the role of the amateur be in broadcasting? Some thought that we should stay out of it and just stick to traffic handling on CW. Others envisioned the amateur as a jack-of-all-trades, expert CW operator and relay station, as well as community broadcaster. In fact, a new name evolved to describe this amateur broadcast hybrid, citizen radio or wireless. Even QST was confused. For a period of time in 1921, the word citizen replaced amateur on the front cover. The other problem was frequencies. Everyone, amateur, broadcaster, and hybrid, was on 200 meters. Tuning across the dial in 1921, one would hear mostly CW, a few spark holdouts, and the new broadcasters. While the amateurs were used to the interference, the general listening public was not. They had purchased their radios to hear music, not CW. Complaints started to pour into the Secretary of Commerce. Legally, he was powerless, as the Radio Act of 1912 offered no solutions. A conference was called for all interested parties held in Washington in February 1922 to try to resolve the impending crisis. Even though he was exceeding his authority under the Radio Act, Secretary Hoover was able to get the following proposals accepted at the conference. 1. Henceforth, special broadcast licenses would be issued. 2 frequencies would be available for broadcasters immediately. 360 meters, or 833 kilocycles, for regular transmissions, and 485 meters, or 619 kilocycles, for crop reports and weather forecasts. 2. After the marine interest had abandoned the 220 to 545 meter range, or 1363 to 550 kilocycles, it would be turned over to broadcasting. 3. Broadcasting was forbidden by amateurs who were defined for the first time by name, as stations operating without pay or commercial gain, merely for personal interest. 4. Quiet hours were imposed on all amateur stations effective from 8 p.m. to 10:30 p.m. daily and on Sunday morning. The fact that the number of broadcasting stations dropped from 1,200 to 30 immediately after these regulations went into effect shows just how many amateurs were in fact pioneer broadcasters. This agreement, however, was a house of cards. Secretary Hoover had stretched his authority under the Radio Act of 1912 well past the breaking point. In 1926, the cards came tumbling down, and the summer of anarchy was ushered in. How would amateurs fare with no enforceable regulations in place? Join us the next time as the Ancient Amateur Archives explores the events leading up to the creation of the Federal Radio Commission.
Your time is up. Go in peace. But return again for our next installment of the Ancient Amateur Archives.
Attention, this week, and amateur radio listeners, have I got news for you. Get over to our website at www.twiar.org and check out our new staff blogs. All the guys at this week are busy putting together their new blogs and diligently writing away even as I speak. See what's going on behind the scenes, read historical backgrounds, and gain insights on personal points of view. And getting there is real easy. Just go to www.twiar.org and click on Staff Blogs. That's www.twiar.org and click on Staff Blogs. Get the inside skimmy on this week in amateur radio right away.
Now with the latest technology news and commentary from Petaluma, California. This Week in Amateur Radio is proud to present Leo Laporte.
Times have changed since I started doing this. You know, I started doing this back in the prehistoric days of DOS 5 and Windows 3, and not 3.1, Windows 3.0. And back then, it was really, you know, I mean, computers were about computers. Technology was about computers. I mean, that's all we talked about was Windows and computers. I guess a little Macintosh too. The Mac was out by then. But it was really focused on, you know, speeds and feeds on bits and bytes on chips and motherboards and how to get this hardware all working together, because it never really did seem to kind of work. And fortunately, that was almost, what, that's, 1992, 16 years ago. Or 91 even, 17 years ago. So we've really evolved since then. And now, fortunately, the hardware is pretty reliable, pretty consistent, very fast. So now what we think about these days is more about what you do with the computer than how do you keep it working, more about the content than the platform. Happened with stereos, too. In the 50s, everybody in stereos was worried about, you know, the tonal harmonic distortion and how many watts RMS per channel. And they didn't really even talk about what you would do with it. Well, if they did, it was, oh, I like the 1812 Overture because those guns and bells really test my speakers. Then in the 60s, it became about music. And hi-fi magazines gave way to Rolling Stone in the same way that computer magazines now are really giving way to the content, to the internet. It's not, you know, we don't want to worry about the platform so much. Much more interested about what you could do with it, which I think is great. So that's what this show is all about. So I'm going to put my pirate voice on now. Arr! And talk a little bit about piracy, eh, me matey? Now this is, I mean, you couldn't pick a better example of why the movie industry is wrong on this issue. His poor wife, going through chemotherapy. She wants to watch some movies while she's getting her treatment. You know, you sit in a chair and they drip stuff into you. She's not going to bring her DVD player and a TV with her. She wants a portable device. An iPod, perfect. She already has it. You could put some movies on it. She can listen on the headphones. Great way to pass time. Except, it's illegal. The movie industry got a law passed some years ago called the Digital Millennium Copyright Act that made it a violation of federal law to reverse engineer copy protection. DVDs are copy protected. It is illegal to crack, reverse engineer, defeat the copy protection, and that's what you have to do to put it on an iPod. It's illegal. Now, the movie industry say, well, Leo, she has every right to buy a copy of that movie in the iTunes store and put it on her iPod. We've made that possible for you. But what if the movie's not available in the iTunes store? Because most aren't. And wait a minute, didn't she already buy that movie from you? Aren't you double-dipping Hollywood?
Well, Leo, every different copy is another copy. You've got to pay for every copy. If you have the Beatles' Let It Be on vinyl, and you want the 8-track, you've got to buy the 8-track. And if you want the cassette, well, you've got to buy it again. And if you want the CD, you've got to buy it again. And if you want the digital download, well, you can't have that. The Beatles don't do that.
So this is their policy, and it's the law of the land. Now, let's get real. People do it every day. I do it every day. I am not making copies of DVDs to put them out on my front lawn on a blanket and sell them. I'm not stealing the DVD. I already own the DVD. I want it on my laptop so I can go on an airplane. And I don't want to carry all the DVDs with you. Yeah, I'm making archival copies. This used to be legal, by the way. It's called fair use. Make an archival copy of a disc you own. And in point of fact, the movie industry is very loath to take this issue to court because what they're afraid of is a court might point that out. Well, that's called fair use. They own the disc. Making a copy of it for archival purposes, surely that's not illegal, movie industry.
Well, pardon.
So here's the deal. Nobody's going to come and get you. Nobody's going to arrest you. Nobody's going to even know you did it. Is it illegal to own a copy of Handbrake? No. Handbrake has legitimate legal uses. If you've got a DVD that the coach made of your son's baseball team and you want to put it on your hard drive, you'd use Handbrake to do that, and that's perfectly legal. So it's legal to sell, legal to own Handbrake. What's illegal is what you're proposing to do, which is rip commercial movies because they're copy protected. If you can find one that's not copy protected, that's legal. So, I guess I'm duty bound to tell you the legalities of it. If you ask me, is it legal? I have to tell you, no, technically it's not. Has anybody ever gone to jail for putting a DVD they own on their iPod? No. Has anybody ever been fined for that? No. I'm not suggesting you put it up on LimeWire and let people download it. Of course. That would be wrong. I'm not suggesting you make copies for your friends or put it on the lawn on a blanket and sell it. That would be wrong, obviously. But is it wrong, and there's a question I have for you, is it wrong to take a movie he owns and make a copy of it on his iPod? I say no. I say that's completely legitimate. But the movie industry and the law of the land says otherwise. So you should know that. It would be really nice if this law were changed. It went way too far. Many members of Congress know it went way too far, believe it went way too far. The law was essentially written by corporate lobbyists for the movie and record industry. My friends in Canada are up in arms about something that could happen here. In fact, if you go to Canada, if you ever go across the border, you might want to be aware of this. Now, I didn't know this, but for a long time, Canadian customs officials have, at random, been opening people's computers, iPods, media devices, and looking at them. They're looking ostensibly for child porn. They don't do it to everybody. It never happened to me. I crossed into Canada once a month for several years. Never happened to me, but apparently, I guess if you... maybe you have to look a certain way. I don't know if they do profiling. But for some reason, some people have been stopped at the border. Their laptops opened up, and the customs officials have rummaged through them. How would you feel about that? And there have been some cases where people have been arrested. Well, get ready for this, because the Canadian government is now negotiating an agreement which could allow them to go through your iPod or your laptop or any other personal electronic device looking for pirated or copyright infringement. They even could check cell phones for content that, quote, infringes on copyright laws. Ripped CDs, ripped DVDs. And by the way, it's proactive. They don't have to have a request from the movie companies to be looking for something like that. The guards are determining what's infringing content. They could confiscate your devices. They could even arrest you or fine you. Even if you, let's say, and as I do all the time, take a DVD, copy it to my laptop so I don't have to, the DVD I own, so I don't have to carry the DVD with me on the plane. That would be a violation. You could lose your laptop. You could be fined. This is a new, this is called ACTA, and it is an extension of the North American Free Trade Agreement, the Anti-Counterfeiting Trade Agreement, ACTA. It's being rushed through Parliament in Canada, And now they could be going through your stuff when you, I'll tell you what, this becomes law in Canada. I'm not going to Canada. Not because I'm afraid of what's going to happen, but that's kind of, I mean, that's going a little far, don't you think? And I have to tell you, it's coming from us. This has been drafted by the United States Office of the Trade Representative. It's coming from the U.S. recording industry and motion picture industry. And I got to say, if they do this in Canada, they'll probably do it going the other way too. How long before, you know, your stuff, they already go through your bags. They're going through your electronic materials looking for pirated stuff. And they get to decide what's pirated, by the way. I think this is going way too far. This is scary stuff. I worries me quite a bit. You might just want to be aware of that. You want to get mad at the recording industry. Here's another story. The recording industry has something they call a company they call Media Defender. Media Defender. Media Defender's job, apparently, is to seek out BitTorrent sites and bring them to their knees. They're defending media. Record companies pay for this. What Media Defender is up to is pretty sketchy. Strikes me as a little illegal. They have 2,000 servers. And what they do is they propagate fake BitTorrent seeds. They launch denial of service attacks against distributors. And it just happened to a company that is absolutely on the up and up, run by some friends of mine called Revision 3. Revision 3 makes their own content. They're not distributing Hollywood movies or records. They sometimes use BitTorrent to do that. BitTorrent is a completely legal way of distributing large files. It is not illegal. In fact, the motion picture industry is a big investor in the company BitTorrent. So Revision 3 has these big video shows. They distribute via BitTorrent in some cases, run a BitTorrent service. Media Defender took them down over the weekend, last weekend. For 3 days, you couldn't get to their servers. They were attacking, Media Defender's servers were attacking Revision 3's servers with a denial of service attack, the kind of thing hackers do, preventing you from getting to the Revision 3 site. The people who pay for Media Defender, including Sony, Universal Music, the Recording Industry Association of America, the Motion Picture Association of America, and they're bringing down sites just randomly because they run BitTorrent servers. Can that possibly be legal? I hope Revision 3 pursues this. They certainly have, I think, a good case for a lawsuit against these guys. This is a legitimate business that was basically put out of business, that unable to serve their advertisements offline for 3 days by this vigilante group. This is vigilanteism. Media Defender. I hope they do something about it. I'm Leo Lapointe, the Tech Guy.
Bummer.
Sigmund, what is the matter?
We just got 2 letters from a big time This Week in Amateur Radio listener.
What could be the problem?
All this guy does is complain.
What does he complain about?
He complains about everything he hears. He doesn't like anything about the program. Not only that, he has issues. Issues with 11 meters. Issues with Canadians. Issues with bandages. You name it, he's got an issue.
Does he give his name? Where does he live?
His name is Robert. No last name. No address.
Bummer. No QSL card for Robert.
Not till he gives us more information.
And yet, he's a big fan.
Yeah, he wishes us continued success.
Attention, This Week in Amateur Radio listeners, we want to hear from you. Let us know you're out there. Drop an email to n2fnh@capital.net. Tell us who you are, where you are, and which podcast you're hearing us on. Do that, and I will send you an official This Week in Amateur Radio QSL card. That's n2fnh@capital.net. To get your official This Week in Amateur Radio QSL card right away. Out.
my field. Bummer.
Finally this week, hams all across North America attend a lot of good ham fests each year, but very few have commercials on broadcast radio inviting the general public to come on down, or in this case, north, north to Alaska.
North to Alaska, go north for us is home. North to Alaska, go north to Russia's own. Big Sam left Seattle.
CQ, CQ, CQ. The Anchorage Amateur Radio Club in Anchorage, Alaska, in association with other Alaskan amateur radio clubs, will be presenting the Great Alaskan Ham Fest Convention this August 1st through the 4th in beautiful downtown Anchorage, Alaska. Great vendors will be on hand, as well as great seminars to attend. Opportunities for events off the convention campus will also be available. For more information, visit us at www.akhamfest.com.
That's Pete Summers, KL2GY, who, besides anchoring the news each week here on This Week in Amateur Radio, he is also the voice of the Anchorage Ham Fest. And in addition to Pete's contribution, the Anchorage Ham Fest will have loads of other activities to make the trek to America's last frontier a memorable outing. And by the way, Peter tells us that there is an opportunity to tour the HARP facility during this year's fest. Again, the dates are August 1st to the 4th at the Anchorage Sheridan Hotel. And as Pete says, to learn more, just take your web browser to www.akhamfest.com and be ready for a lot of ham radio fun in America's 49th state.
North to Alaska, go north to Russia's own. North to Alaska, go north to Russia's own. Way up north, way up north, way up north.
And while we're talking about KL2GY and radio spots, take a listen to this.
June 28th and 29th, thousands of amateur radio operators across this great country will put their emergency communication skills to the test for the annual field day. But it's not just for amateur radio operators. You are invited to stop by. Come experience the hobby we call amateur radio. You can even get on the air. Visit your local radio club's website to find out how you can become a part of ARRL's Field Day 2008. Field Day, sponsored by the American Radio Relay League.
This Week in Amateur Radio's producer George Bowen, W2XBS, wrote the script, and Peter voiced the spots that you can run on your local repeater promoting Field Day. There are actually three spots available on This Week in Amateur's website. The first two are for air on local repeaters and one for local broadcast radio promotion. Visit the website to download these for your repeater and local club's field day promotion. Visit us at www.twiar.org.
That wraps up another edition of This Week in Amateur Radio International. We're back again next week right here on WBCQ on 7.415 megahertz. Same time, same station, with another edition of This Week in Amateur Radio International. The program is produced by our all-volunteer amateur radio staff and originates from Albany, New York. If you have broadcast experience, we'd love to have you join the team. We're always looking for anchors and segment producers, and if that tickles your fancy, contact our executive producer by email at the following address: w2xbs@twiar.org. Our snail mail address is This Week in Amateur Radio International, P.O. Box 30, Sand Lake, New York, 12153. Our worldwide audience would love to hear about your product or service, too. If you're an advertiser, call us at area code 518-283-3665 or via email to adsales@twiar.org. If you joined us late, the entire program is available via podcast, along with custom versions heard on amateur radio repeater systems throughout the world. Everything you need can be found online at www.twiar.org. This Week in Amateur Radio International is licensed under a Creative Commons Attribution Share-alike license. And now, for all of us who bring you This Week in Amateur Radio International, this is Scott Westerman, W9WSW, live to hard drive from our studios in Albuquerque, New Mexico, saying 73 until next week.
That was wonderful.
Bravo.
I loved it. that?
Oh, it was great.
Well, it was pretty good.
Well, it wasn't bad.
Well, there were parts of it that weren't very good, though.
It could have been a lot better.
I didn't really like it.
It was pretty terrible.
It was bad.
It was awful.
Oh, damn.
Get him away.
Hey, boo.
Now we return you to the test card and some music.
You're still here? It's over. Go home.
This Week in Amateur Radio International is a production of Community Video Associates, Incorporated.
This is the world-famous WBCQ, Monticello, Maine, USA.
This is the planet, here for you, WBCQ.